really I've come to any website.
Really fun. And Johnny Friedman is really good.
Yeah.
They're both really good.
By the way, Rich suggested that you speak second after Olivia.
Okay.
Just because they're going to sort of cover quite some ground. It would be good to have a...
mix up.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Cool.
There's always a little problem.
All right, I think I'll start now.
Yep.
Cool. Good afternoon, everybody. My name's George Eaton. I'm the political editor of The New Statesman. This afternoon's session is on the mountain to climb. How does Labour win in the 2020s? And I thought of potentially renaming it the masochist session because unfortunately it's quite a grim picture with boundary changes, individual electoral registration, the trade union bill, the cuts to short money, and that's before you even get to whether the current party and leadership is performing well or not. But with us to discuss all of that, we have Richard Angel, who of course is the director of Progress, founded Labour's three seats challenge and has run many marginal seat campaigns for Labour and its sister party in Australia, and perhaps most notably in Ilford North, where Streeting was successfully elected against the odds. We have Olivia Bailey, who's the research director at the Fabians and was previously political advisor to Angela Eagle. We have the pollster and strategist James Morris, who formerly worked for Ed Miliband and runs GQR's London office, where he is a partner. And we have the journalist Ellie Mayer Hagen, who writes regularly for Commenters Free and has also written for The Times, The Independent, Foreign Policy, Al Jazeera, The New Statesman, excellent title, and New Humanist, amongst others. And we're going to begin with Olivia.
Great. Thank you very much. Can everybody hear me okay?
Yeah.
Lovely. I just want to do three things to introduce the debate today. First of all, I want to talk a little bit about some Fabian research on the electoral landscape post-May. I then want to sort of bust a few myths about some of the solutions that we hear at the minute to Labour's electability problem, before I suggest a few lessons the Labour Party should learn to conclude. So first of all, the electoral landscape that post-May. We will all remember, a few minutes past 10, that kind of crushing devastation as we realised we thought we might have done it, and then we really didn't just lose, we lost really badly. It was our worst defeat since 2010, which was our worst defeat in turn since 1918, and in the words of John Cruddas, I think we lost to everyone, everywhere. It was a really bad defeat. And if that wasn't bad enough, Fabian research published shortly after the election shows that the defeat has also triggered a devastating reversal in Labour's electoral fortunes, meaning it's now much harder for us to win than it has been for a very long time. So, for example, while we won a majority of 66 in 2005 with just 35% of the vote, to win a majority of one in 2020, we calculate we're going to need to win 40% of the vote. That's a swing of around 9.5 percentage points in the key marginals. It's double the size of the swing we needed in 2015. And the last time we achieved a swing that size was in 1997. And there are other factors working against us too. The first is the collapse of the Liberal Democrats and the Greens, who between them only won 12% of the vote in May. Their collapse means there are now fewer left-leaning votes to squeeze. And on our calculations, that means that four out of the five votes we need to win in 2020 will have to come from people who voted Conservative in May. The second additional challenge is Scotland. A projected swing of 9.5 percentage points assumes a modest recovery in Scotland. If we don't make a modest recovery in Scotland, we're going to have to win even more seats in England and Wales and achieve a swing we've never previously achieved before. And thirdly, our current position in the polls. We've heard about it this morning. But at this point in the cycle, we are far too low in the share of the vote. We're around 30%. Whereas, we can safely assume, if you look at previous examples from previous oppositions, that you usually lose about 10 points over the course of an opposition. So if we stay on this track, we are on course to lose well over 100 MPs. Not just lose in 2020, but lose really, really badly. So it's a really sobering picture. And I suppose that in the face of that, sobering picture that there's lots of hopeful solutions floating about what we can do about Labour's electability problem. We've heard them all. Blair lost 4 million votes, we can get them back. Austerity's going to kick in and people will come back to us. Left policies are popular and some of them are. We can inspire non-voters back to the polls. They all sound logical, perhaps even some of them are possible. But the sad reality is that even if they are, they aren't enough. Take the example of winning over non-voters. Even if we were able to secure a Scotland-style surge in turnout of 7.3%, which I think is a reasonable comparison to draw, we would still be only halfway, and every single one of those new voters voted Labour, we'd still be only halfway to getting a majority. And take the argument that Labour can unite left-leaning voters, something which I am sure Jeremy Corbyn can do. The problem is that Labour would not win sufficient marginal seats to form a government, even in the highly implausible scenario of Labour first achieving a Scotland-style surge in turnout, with every extra voter choosing Labour, and second, winning over every single person who voted Liberal Democrat and Green in 2015. The only way Labour can win in 2020 is by securing the votes of people who voted Conservative in May. So what are the lessons for the party? The first, I think, is to heed the words of the new Canadian Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, who said that we need to treat Conservative voters as friends and not enemies. You know, the only way we can be electable again is to reach out to the political centre ground. The second thing to say is that doesn't mean that a radical agenda can't work. It just means that we need to keep our tent big. We need to keep hold of the centre while also appealing to the left, a challenge that it is possible to meet. And the last thing I want to say is this. I think the Labour Party should not just give in. It would be easy in the face of this impossible picture to just focus on cementing your position and control of the levers of power in the Labour Party, to focus on the 500,000 Labour members, not at least trying to cling on to the 9 million people who voted for us in May. But when Labour's first MP, Keir Hardie, caused absolute consternation in the chamber when he walked in wearing a cloth cap and not a top hat, he knew exactly what his purpose was, and he knew exactly what the purpose of his party was, and that is to be a voice for working people in Parliament and to govern in the interests of working people. So unless we learn the lessons of May, unless we start focusing really seriously on how we can become electable again, we will continue to let people down. And that means millions of people continuing to go hungry in one of the richest countries in the world. It means people will continue to live in poverty despite being in work. It means the old and the disabled living without care. And it means that we will have to sit back and watch as the welfare state that we built is undone. So the purpose of the Labour Party is to govern in the interest of the working people of this country. If we don't do everything in our power to do that, then we're letting the country down. And to turn our backs on the electorate because it's too hard, or because our politics are too pure, that would be a disgrace. Thank you.
Thank you, Olivia. Now we're going to hear from Ellie.
Do I have to stand? I hate standing. Do you mind if I sit? Can you hear me? Do I need the mic closer? Okay. Now that's all done. Thank you very much for having me. I might have seen some of you already at the fringe that I did with Fabians at the Labour conference, and I'll try to have less argy-bargy in this one. John McTiernan was on the panel, so that's always a source of explosions. How do we win in the 2020s? How does Labour win in the 2020s? Well, I just want to start by just recapping on where we are, what people's lives are like at the moment under this government. We know that there's a big rise in self-employment, but self-employed wages have fallen quite significantly. We know that wages overall have fallen. We know that there's rubbish childcare. Now that's like really bad for people's lives, but what does it mean for us who want to sort of convince people to vote Labour? It means that people are busy. They're busy working really long hours. They're busy worrying about how they're going to make ends meet. And they're busy trying to fit their childcare around their jobs and that kind of thing. And what that means is people don't have time for activism. We really want people to become engaged political activists who go to community meetings all the time and who consume, you know, live blogs about the news voraciously, as probably people on this panel do and maybe many of you in the room do. But the fact is that we've created, or we've allowed an economy to be created in this country that simply disbars the vast majority of people from being politically engaged because they don't have time and they don't have the kind of what you might call psychological room to be able to do that because they're too busy physically working and caring for their children or mentally worrying about how they're going to make ends meet. So that means it's unrealistic for Labour to think it can bypass the media. The media, unfortunately, for Labour, because I do think that Jeremy Corbyn gets a tough time in the media is the way that Labour will communicate to the vast majority of people in this country. It's not through activism and getting people, out and into community meetings and that kind of thing, into their local Labour Party. Unfortunately, the vast majority of people in this country will understand what Labour's about through the media. So given people are really busy, how long do you think that that the average person spends a day listening to what the Labour Party has to say? Maybe like 30 seconds? So if you're asking how do we win in the 2020s, my advice is use those 30 seconds wisely. You've got 30 seconds a day to put your message to the public. You better be damn sure what you're going to say, and you better make it as clear and concise as possible. You better say you better communicate your ideas in the simplest way possible. You need to tell a convincing story about the country that is grounded in the reality of people's everyday experiences. And then you need to distill that story into short, sharp, key messages that you repeat over and over and over again. Even if you say them three times a day, that might seem ridiculous, but the fact is, the people that you're talking to, they've only got 30 seconds, so maybe 10 seconds of that will go in. And that is how you make progress. And then the other thing I wanted to say, which is a bit off-piste, it's a bit different to the argument I've just made, that some of you may have been reading that there's sort of rumblings of rumours that there might be another financial crisis. So, have you been reading about that? That in the news there's been a lot of... Yeah, I wasn't sure how... whether I'm just friends with people who like catastrophes or whether that wasn't widely. And what I would say is this. A lot of people I know on the left have sort of come to the conclusion that if there's a financial crisis while the Tories are in power, then people will just fall into Labour's arms. That will not happen. Nobody can rest on their laurels and just expect that that will happen. Because what happened in the last financial crisis was that people just went with the most convincing argument. And the Tories worked really, really hard to convince people that their explanation for the financial crisis was the right one. The fact that it worked shows how important messaging is, because it wasn't the right one. It was completely bananas. So Labour cannot just wait and hope, or rather people on the left in general can't just wait for another financial crisis to happen under the Tories and expect that the voters will just flock to them. That it's all about the message, it's all about the explanation for people's social circumstances. And I was reading an article this morning on my way here that said that people are actually a lot more left-wing than they realise and perhaps we realise. Because if you ask them, they'll identify as centrist or centre-right, but then if you ask them about specific policy positions, they're much more left-wing than perhaps they might anticipate or that we might anticipate. So doesn't it show how important a good message is that this government can get repeatedly elected if people actually, when you drill down to policy, probably are to the left of this government? To me, that shows how important telling a convincing story, having clear, concise, repetitive messages is to convincing the public to vote for you. And obviously it's a huge question, and I could go on all day about it, but that's just one small answer to this very big question that I'd like to offer. So thank you for listening.
Thank you, Ellie. Richard.
Thank you. I want to start by saying I believe we could have won the 2010 election and we could have won the 2015 election. And there was nothing in the 2015 result that meant we couldn't have gone on to win in 2020. And I still believe we can. But the decision is in our hands in so many ways about whether we take that choice. And I'm afraid that those who are angry at what the Tories are doing to the NHS, to our public services, to all that we care about in this country, we all have to take it on ourselves for the decisions we made in the past, that meant they did win those two elections, because in both cases they were reluctant victories for the Tories. You know, we denied the Tories a majority in 2010 because they really did not want to go with what David Cameron was offering. They just believed we were offering worse. At the last election, there's about a million people that were wanting to vote Labour and telling pollsters a week before they were going to, who when they turned up, they wavered and they voted Tory. Wendliff says that 4 out of 5 of the voters we need to win to get a majority voted Conservative last time. We're not talking about their party members or their ideologues or their fellow travellers. We're talking about a million Britons who held their pen over wanting an excuse to vote Labour but couldn't find it. So my first thing that I want to ask the audience and everybody here and our party is, can we resolve one thing together? To never go into an election with such low aspirations. A 35% strategy was appalling. The idea we're going to hold all of our vote was clearly an overestimation. And the idea we could just get these left votes off the Liberal Democrats and a couple of Greens was ridiculous. If you are not in the game of winning votes off your main opponents, you are not in the game at all. And the reason why those of us who fetishise about winning votes over the Tories do so is not because I enjoy it more or because I want to win some kind of right-wing argument or because I would want Labour to be ideally positioned on the centre ground as it is currently. Because when you do it, you get 2 votes for our party. You get 1 off their pile and 1 onto ours. It is so rewarding when you do that switch, and the return for working people in this country is so great. At the last election, we needed 67 seats to get a majority of 1. By the month before polling day, we were only resourcing 61 seats. Right? By our own resourcing, we weren't aiming to win a general election, and we are surprised we didn't win a general election. This appalls me, and it is therefore logical that if you are not even aiming to win enough seats, that people would then ask, well, who are you going to share power with? If you can't possibly take power on your own, who would you share power with? And if you are wishing to win an election, I would suggest you don't have as part of your coalition a party of whose brand and ideas and spokespeople you cannot control, because you are very likely to get what you say you want in doing so. And of course, we saw how that attack on sharing power with the SNP destroyed our party so much. So how do we win the next election? I think there's 3 broad things. Firstly, we have to nail why we did lose the last election. And it is really tough, and lots of the messages are really tough for all of us who want a more socially and progressive Britain. The first thing, the party's got to release this Beckett report and the whole thing. No redactions, no exclusions. If people were named, they need to be named in public. We should have it out and have the discussion, because the people who worked hard to try and get us a victory should know if the people from whom we take so much advice, from whom we follow in Labour Party HQ and in the leadership, if they know why we lost as well. Because if they don't know why we lost, they'll never be able to chart a route back. But ultimately we lost, and there's all the kind of particulars, because we had no vision and no credibility, and that ended up to be a very horrid and nasty compromise. And one of the things that I think people traditionally associated with kind of my wing of the party have done and made us a huge mistake, and this is an opportunity for us to reflect on where we've gone wrong in the past, is that because we have lost 2 elections because we didn't have economic credibility, we're going out in search of this holy grail of economic credibility. Well, I think it doesn't exist. It is neither a means nor an end in our politics. We need to go out and have a big, broad, exciting vision for this country. We need to have a plan for the economy we want to build for working people. I wrote in my last editorial, you cannot lead a social democratic party without an economic vision for your party and your country. None of the 3 ABC candidates had one, and no wonder they fell short for doing so. But they did. One of the reasons they didn't is they were looking for technocratic ways of being credible. The credibility is the test. Do your big ideas, your policies you have meet your big idea, and are they reasonable to enough people? The test comes afterwards, but we must first find our passion and vision for the economy we want to build. Currently, the way things work are rigged against the people I came into politics for, and I imagine that is true for so many people in this room. Let's sort that out first, and then meet the test of are these policies we're coming up with going to meet that big vision, and are they reasonable to enough people? And then we can start doing the compromising. But when we go in on day one looking for the compromise, we will come out losing. The big, bold vision has got to be an exciting one, and I think one of the things that has hampered our party for too long is we took a picture of Britain in 1997, we drew on it 100 new hospitals, civil partnerships, and all the wonderful things that we did, and I will defend to a hilt under that government. What we haven't been able to do is retake the picture of Britain in 2010 or 2015, or even one on a sense of where it might be in 2020. Let's do that, and then let's draw the picture of where we want us to be, not in 2025, because I don't want a one-term Labour government. I want a three-term Labour government that can really radically change the vested interests in this country in our favour. Let's draw that picture and draw the line between the two, and we can take people with us. But you have to start with the world as it is, not as you would want it to be. And I would suggest that some of the frame that that has to be done in is that we have to marry security and aspiration for people. For too many, they feel they're losing and the system is rigged against them, and they are right to feel that. For too many, they just want simple things. Somebody talked about just simply having a takeaway on a Friday night, let alone the family holiday, owning a car or your own house. Marrying those two things together is a way of talking about things traditionally been seen very far to the left of our British politics, and equally taking on some of the parties that try to populate the debate on the right of British politics, and we can bring those together in exciting vision for our country. Once we have done that, then we should unite. The idea of uniting before the debate, I'm afraid, will cast us into a net that means we do not win going forward. The only good thing the last Tory government did was give us a fixed-term parliament, and we know that we have 5 years until that general election. In a fixed-term parliament, in 5 years in particular, most governments start running out of steam at the end of that time. So let's plan at our attacks going forward. Let's decide some of the things we're having. Let's have a proper debate about where we go. But more importantly, let's have a fun, exciting vision that takes with us the Labour voters we came into politics for, and unites with them their friends and neighbours who will vote in solidarity for a better and more prosperous Britain. Thank you.
Thank you, Richard, and finally James.
I think there's a lot of good advice there and a lot of good communications advice. I think one thing that's particularly important is to bear in mind, the easy answer to this question is, after 10 years of Tory government, people in Britain will be desperate for change, Labour will be changed, so they'll vote Labour. And I don't think that's true, and I don't think it's true for two reasons. One is, they won't necessarily be desperate for change, and secondly, they won't necessarily trust Labour to deliver the change, even if they are. So we have to do something about both of those things. So the first bit, which we won't talk about very much, is making sure that people are desperate for change. If you look at back in Labour in the 1980s, it was a complete failure of an attack message through that period. So it took until the ERM crash and there actually being leaks in the roofs of hospitals and schools before people actually felt this was bad for me. That is a rhetorical failure. The country was much worse than that, but Labour picked issues and fights that didn't make people desperate for change. It, in fact, in some ways, strengthened the Conservative Party. So one thing you've got to do is pick an attack that makes people see what they're doing is hurting me and hurting my family, and I need this change. So that is one really important thing, and over the last Parliament, the attack was varied so much that you never knew what it was that was supposed to hit, and no one's ever landed a blow on Cameron. No one landed a blow on Cameron when he took over. They deliberately gave him a pass for a year and then didn't hit. So that's one thing. Second thing is then to be a party that offers change they want and change they can believe in. And I think there's two parts of credibility and something they want. Change they want, I totally agree with what Richard said about having a positive vision that relates to people. People are risk averse, so even if they think things are bad, they always think they could be worse.
Yep.
And as an opposition, you always have a bigger burden of proof to prove that you can be trusted. So you've got to establish that you will not change things for the worse. Part of that, one of the places that's going to be a particularly big issue for the Labour Party is on the issue of immigration, because 73% of people in Britain think that we need to reduce the level of immigration here. 58% of black and ethnic minority voters think we need to reduce the level of immigration here. Only 15% disagree with that statement. Labour is seen as a party that will that want an open borders immigration policy. The Conservatives are doing stuff that's not working very well to try and tighten it up, but as a brand, they look much more in line with British public on that, and UKIP are more in line with British public on that. And if Labour doesn't address its reputation on that issue, it is going to be a massive risk on immigration, whatever great economic vision we have. So one thing we've got to do is work out how to deal with that issue around immigration, diversity, multiculturalism, not have a closed borders kind of policy, not become UKIP, but have a credible and authentic position on that issue. We also need to have something to offer, and it needs to be something, and this is what Richard said in a way, at the last election, the offer by the end, David Axelrod described it as vote Labour, get a free microwave. Because it was like, here's a thing, we'll give you as cheap a rent, we'll give you this. It was like a series
of... Can we have his money back then?
It was like an Argos catalogue of stuff. And that's not politics, right? That's not what people want from a political party. They want to believe they get those benefits, but they want to know that your values reflect theirs, and that the things that they feel are profoundly problematic, you will address. They don't believe you if you just say, here's some stuff. So Labour's got to have an offer that is consonant with people's values and Labour values, and as Ellie said, those are much closer together than it sometimes seems. They also then need to trust you to deliver that, and that's where fiscal policy is going to be a particularly big issue. So I think it is fair to say, on balance, that there wasn't a single problem the Labour Party saw while it was in office that it didn't think needed more money to solve. And the result of that is people think that whenever you see a problem, you need more money to solve it. And that's not the way anyone lives their life. And at times, it was pretty obviously fabricated. So in the 2005 election campaign, Labour ran big attack ads that were like warning posters that said, beware, £35 billion of Tory cuts. The Tory fiscal plan was to increase spending, but not as much as Labour wanted to increase spending. It wasn't like now, where they are reducing spending. They wanted to increase spending. Labour made, we will spend more, the denominator for being a good government. And that worked. It worked really well when there were leaks in hospital roofs, but it doesn't work so well now we've built 100 hospitals. And when the financial crisis came, people don't think that spending sunk banks. They think that's why the Tory attack was Labour didn't mend the roof when the sun was shining. They think that Labour didn't manage things in the long run such that it was careful with money, and it still thinks, if there's a problem, spend more money. So we're going to need to have some kind of economic approach that doesn't just assume spending more money is the answer to every problem, because that doesn't show any change from where Labour was before. That doesn't mean accepting Tory spending plans necessarily. In fact, if you want to argue that we need increased borrowing, rates are low, there's an investment deficit in Britain, it's even more important that you are seen as thrifty skinflint. Because if you are seen as a really tight bastard, then they might trust you when you say we've got to go and spend £10 million on a bridge. But if you're seen as someone who wants to spend £10 million every time you see some rubbish in the street, they're not going to trust you. So it's a bit like saying a glass of red wine a day is good for you. I will trust a doctor who tells me that, and I will not trust an alcoholic who tells me that. Labour's not the doctor in that situation. I'll say three final things very briefly. One is, it's got to be coherent, consistent message. So that 30 seconds a day thing's absolutely right. And at the moment, that isn't there, and it's got to be there. The second thing, I just want to pick up something I said earlier, which is about what Labour does about its record. Now, Tom said, if they keep telling you that that every previous model of the car was crap, you're not going to buy a new one from them. After presiding over the deepest financial crisis since the Great Recession, the Iraq War, and an unexpected surge in immigration, Labour is not Ford, Labour is Skoda. And Skoda exactly did say, every previous model was crap, we've got something new now. And so did New Labour. So the idea that Labour has just made some small little errors and we'll just sort it out and we'll persuade everyone that everything else was good is ridiculous. It's not going to work, right? Labour maybe it could have worked 5 years ago, I don't think so. Maybe it could have worked 7 years ago. It's not going to work for 2020, and it's not what Labour did between 1995 and 1997 either. So I think it's exactly the wrong advice. I do think that it's winnable, but I think you've just got to think about what win means. A majority in 2020 is extremely unlikely. We haven't talked about the problems in Scotland, but they're in a way even deeper than the problem. Scotland's got all the problems of England, plus a whole other load of problems. So it's not very likely, it's not realistic to ask players to turn that around so quickly. That's a real long haul. So winning means forming a government. And I do think that if you set that as a threshold, it is totally doable, but it is a narrow path that Labour's got to walk down, and it's got to get on that path really quickly to be able to get there.
Thanks, James. I'm going to take questions from you now, ladies and gentlemen. I'll take them in groups of three, and I emphasise questions, not speeches, please. And I will take the lady there first.
Thank you. I'm Rebecca. I'm the Women's Officer in Feldbourne. I think one of Labour's big problems is marrying our social vision of equality with aspiration without spending too much money. So, for example, when people finally get their house or when they finally set up their new business, they don't want this idea that because they set it up, they're going to have money taken away from them. We need to find a way to support people who have reached their aspirations whilst at the same time instilling quality in society but not spending too much. What are your thoughts on that?
Okay, I'll take the gentleman there.
Hi, I'm Louis. I was just wondering what you thought of the efficacy of negative campaigning. I think on the Staggers the other day I read about the negative campaigns against Zach Goldsmith and how they might not be effective. But as a tactic, how does negative campaigning fit into our strategy to win?
And Lady.
Well, my question is a little bit like Labour. I think when I look at this room, and forgive me if I'm wrong, I think full of intelligence people. I don't see people of white working class that Labour has left long time, and I wonder how Labour can get those core voters, because I believe when I hear speeches of politicians, I don't hear them talking to the white working class or ethnic minority, because they took that for granted, and that's why we have UKIP today. What are we going to do if we are to win 2020? Thank you.
Thanks. Olivia, do you want to start?
Okay, Rebecca, I think you're totally right. I think that when I sort of set out our objective being winning over people who voted Conservative in May as one of our core objectives, a lot of those people were thinking first and foremost about themselves, their jobs and their families, and we shouldn't think critically of them for it. They have a social conscience, of course, but they also have to make decisions in the interests of themselves and their families. So that's why it's really important that any offer we have, well, first of all, we need to sell our values better, you know, sell having a social conscience, sell wanting a more equal society, but also saying we understand that you want to get on. And that's of absolute crucial importance. And it also, you know, echo all the points that have been made about the importance of us kind of regaining control of the narrative and not letting the Tories run us around the park on the economy, for example. Louis, on negative campaigning, I'll let others answer it, but other than to say at the minute we seem to be doing all the negative campaigning against ourselves. and so perhaps we need to start, you know, we had some really good stuff going in the last Parliament that was quite effective, and I think it's really important that we get an operation up and going again on the Tories rather than ourselves. And the final question, sorry, I didn't catch your name.
My name is Raki Ismail. I'm a councillor, a Labour councillor at Islington Council.
Great, thank you. It's a really important question, and I'll just say two quick things on it. The first is, I think the Labour Party's in a real danger of losing its core voters in its heartland seats, and I think in 10, 20 years' time we could be looking at losing some of the seats that we take completely for granted. So I think it's of absolute crucial importance that we start to both look like in terms of our representatives, but also speak to the concerns of those people and understand them better. And just quickly to chuck in a plug for a bit of Fabian work we're doing, and there's also a fringe discussion on this later on the diversity of Labour's representatives, which is again of absolute crucial importance. And I think there are definitely some concerns about, you know, whilst it's good that the Shadow Cabinet's 50% women, you know, other diversity questions in our current top team, there's some real worries there. So I think it's really important the Labour Party kind of ups its game on that.
Yeah, particularly because when I'm knocking
sorry,
off,
sorry.
I'm sorry, just quickly, I
want to make... Ellie, do you want to...
Okay, Rebecca, the aspiration question. I think the aspiration is like a really thorny word because the Tories have kind of taken it and used it essentially to mean embracing capitalism and embracing neoliberalism and... sorry, not neoliberalism, although that too, but materialism. And what we mean when we say aspiration usually is... the desire to sort of advance yourself and to sort of ignore at the kind of expense of everybody else. It's really, it's a byword for that. But aspiration can also mean, it can mean social equality, because, you know, there are lots of things that this government is doing that's standing in the way of aspiration, like encouraging low-paid jobs and unpaid internships, by preventing people, having policies that prevent people from owning their own homes, that kind of thing, and tuition fees. And these are also sort of forms of aspiration, that the kind of society and labour values can be a vehicle through which people can realise their aspirations to better themselves. And so I think what we need to do is we need to reclaim aspiration from the right and define it as something that is a value of social equality. Louis, negative campaigning. I think it can. Like, I think the last election shows that it can be very effective. But I think that Michael Howard's campaign shows that it can also be a total failure. And I think that, for me, the big difference between negative campaigning that's effective and ineffective is that you've got to have ideas. And I think the same thing happened in the leadership election, which is that every attack on Corbyn only seemed to bolster him further, and it was because the other candidates had nothing. They just had a thing. And even though, like, I was supportive and I spoke in favour of him, I had no particular personal loyalty to Corbyn. I would have voted for someone else, but I was like, you're not giving me anything, I can't vote for you, I don't know what, there's nothing. Negative campaigning can be effective if it's married with, like, an offer, an idea, like, you know. Otherwise, I just don't think it will work. And in terms of the white working class, now that is a really big question. And my short answer is quite depressing, which is I don't think that it's going to be easy for Labour to undo 30 years of ignoring its working class base while it tries to woo Daily Mail voters. Like, I come from one of these communities, and we are pissed off at the way we've been taken for granted for such a really long time. And I think, you know, a very simple explanation of the SNP is that there was a sense of political abandonment in Scotland, and all it took was a party to come along that seemed to that offered convincing arguments with, admittedly, a badass leader. Nicola Sturgeon's an incredible politician. Yeah. And then people just flocked towards it and abandoned Labour. And I think, you know, if another party, I think that UKIP, like, they're a bit, they've got, like, lots of issues, so I'm not sure that they'll necessarily be the ones. They seem incompetent and reactionary, and I don't think that the working class in this country are the unreconstructed racists that they're often made out to be in the press. But all it'll take is a party to come along that seems like a viable alternative to Labour, and the working class core vote will go there in droves because they've been treated like mugs. And I think it's going to take a lot of work and a lot of humility and a long time to mend that. It's been happening for too long. Sorry, that's depressing, but that's my answer.
Thanks, Richard.
The first thing I would say is that we can't let all the Tories to own the term aspiration. I don't actually believe they do. I think that we want aspiration to mean something other than what most people think it does. And we have to engage with it on the terms that most people think it does. The example that the guy in the room used as aspiration was having a takeaway on a Friday night. And we were hardly talking about materialism of wanting your own personal car to drive you around in the world. You know, materialism is a big thing in your life if you have nothing and you want quite basic things to do that. And if we don't talk about helping people reach quite basic needs, and we have this quite... And we also look down on wanting you and your family to have what is seen as minimums for other people, then we are in a different world to many of our voters and those in which we most rely on, and in which in these events we say we most talk about, but we never seem to talk with them, because they're the language and the things that they talk about back to us when I'm in the pub at home or around the dinner table with my slightly right-wing family. And that comes to the last question, which is this bit about, it's very kind that you call us intelligent, thank you for that, it's new. I am from a family where I was on free school meals, and I hate talking about that. I never ever described myself as working class until I joined the Labour Party and had to stand in an election, and it was then for somehow this kind of tick box exercise that we kind of fetishise poverty and the the backgrounds we came from, rather than live the politics that I believe in, which is about where you're going to and wanting an inclusive place about the direction of travel you're going in. So you shouldn't be privileged at the start with the private school education that where only 7% of you get you 35% of Russell Group places. But equally, fetishising the opposite of that becomes a problem, and it actually is a barrier for some of those of us with working class backgrounds to talk in the Labour Party. And partly now, because I am not working class in any way, shape or form. I had a decent salary, I'm a gay man in London who lives a kind of lovely lifestyle going to the theatre, right? So I neither want to get out the kind of violin of the past, Owen's laughing, and I neither have to take out the kind of violin of the past, which I don't want to talk about. And I did a piece recently for Progress, partly talking about, I wanted to make it a bit more personal. And I had to go home to see my mum to talk her through the piece that I'd written, because she hates it every time I talk about what it was like when we were poor at home. Because for her, she saw that as failure. And when she came off benefits, she voted Tory. She came off benefits because she was helped by a Labour government that got off benefits. But she saw herself as no longer a failure and therefore able to vote Tory. Now, if that isn't a kind of reflection, and that was under New Labour, right? And if that is not a reflection for all of us, I don't know what is. Now, Scotland kind of got mentioned in some of the answers, and it is linked to this taking people for granted. In Scotland, we did take people for granted, and we do it in lots of places in this country. I went out in the referendum with an MP who had to be introduced to parts of his seat, and people weren't interested in being introduced to him because they'd never met him and never seen him out and about in their communities. I'm afraid that is taking people for granted. I remember in 2005, before the Liberal Democrats went into coalition and they were all, kind of ruined the way they are now brand-wise. A guy called Andrew Gwynn, who just ran the by-election in Oldham, became the MP. And his seat straddles two boroughs, one's more Tory and one's more Labour. And he had about the 15th safest seat in the country. All but one ward had opposition councillors. Within 3 years, he got rid of every opposition councillor bar one. Because he just, and what he did with his communications allowance in the House of Commons, he bought a RISO, and he just delivered more leaflets than they had ever seen before. He used a Lib Dem strategy back at them, and he talked to his own voters, and he engaged with them, and not only did he get rid of all the Lib Dems and the Tories in places where we basically had taken people granted, because don't worry, we'll take the parliamentary seat anyway, and that's the only bit that really matters, apparently. He went and worked them out of his local area. And we look around the country, while we were in office, the Deputy Prime Minister represented Hull, his local council was a Liberal Democrat council, and there was very little campaigning that had happened in that area for a long time. And that was the case across the country. But we didn't say lots of those things because there were very important people in government and the discrepancy was a really big problem. And it's hard to give some of those messages, but there are places in the country where at the moment or in the recent past, we have let people down and we have taken people for granted, and we must reflect on that and we must do more to go out and speak to those people and take their aspirations with us.
Thank you. And James?
Not a lot left to say, actually. I'll just say two things quickly. One is on negative campaigning. There are two things that are really important. One is, if you're the opposition, you are riskier. Right, because you just haven't done anything in the last 5 years. So you can point to things you've achieved in local government, but at a national level, you haven't done anything actually in the last 10 years. So you're riskier. By the end of the parliament, there'll be a lot of new faces. People won't know that they've got any executive experience. That gives them an opportunity because they're not tied with the past, but also makes them riskier. You've got to make the incumbent risky. You've got to. You've got to say, they've just handed over to this clown who used to go, have I got news for you? He doesn't have a clue. Here are some things he screwed up in London, or whatever. So there is no alternative, there's no other way to make the government risky than to say it. And so you've got to attack them. People do not like negative campaigning, as in, what's your favourite tactic? It's not my favourite tactic. But does it work? Yes. Mm-hmm. You've got to do it, you've got to do it coherently. And the other thing is, in opposition, you can choose what rows there are by choosing where to attack. So if Labour spends a week attacking the Tories on the rise of homelessness, that's going to put that issue in the news. If you spend the time putting together a detailed document on how they missed their fiscal targets, that will be in the news. And you've got choices then about whether we want to sort of compound their reputation for being heartless or damage their reputation for being competent. And you've got to decide which those are up. You do. But that's actually one of the few things you can decide in opposition, because you don't have the government grid ability to announce new stuff that is actually going to happen in the world. So for all those reasons, particularly in opposition, attack is really, really important. The other thing actually, in terms of media consumption, is that there's this shift towards people consuming more and more video online. And British regulation of advertising just hasn't caught up with online media. So you can run negative attack ads before someone watches a YouTube clip of David Bowie's last album, right, which got 1 million views probably at the weekend. So now you can use video to attack them, and video attack ads are really powerful, but you need money to do that. So actually the money is really important in terms of getting attacks across, and you should think creatively about how to use it. I just want to say one other thing on the white working class, which is Labour's unbelievably lucky at the moment that UKIP has had a meltdown. Their vote has not gone down at all, but organisationally they've got like five factions, they've got one MP, and all their money has gone to the one of the Leave campaigns, the like slightly weirder Leave campaign. That is really, really lucky for Labour, because if they had a galvanising leader who was not a like stereotypical UKIP person, so if they had a Geert Wilders kind of person, Labour would have a massive problem in the white working class. So it's not because white working class voters are racist, it's because Labour's brand is so tarred for all of the reasons that we talked about that they've got a massive opportunity to do that. But they aren't. They're not going to do that. They look totally divided, so that's not going to happen. The thing to bear in mind, if you look at white working class voters around the world, left of centre parties try to appeal to them by appealing to their economic interest. And they do tend to get a majority of working class voters. But they try and get more by trying to make even stronger economic offers. But if you look at white working class voters voting Republican, it's not because they want, they think that they'll get better wages under the Republicans. And it's the same in Britain. It's a cultural thing. So the Labour Party's got to find ways to connect with people, not by saying you'll earn more if you vote Labour, because most of those people are with us. It's reaching out to the next block who have a much deeper kind of cultural problem and see the intelligentsia in London and think, I've no idea what that person's got to do with me, and they don't understand my life, and they don't have the same values I have. And it goes to the point about, like, if I move into my home, I'm going to lose money that I've been getting previously. It's the kind of thing that makes people think, God, if you're suggesting that, you don't know what my life's like.
Thanks. I'll take some more. Yes, sir.
One thing that baffles me about Labour is that effective parties have leaders who can attack their opponents very effectively. David Cameron is superb at this. He has a simple message, two or three simple ones, and it's repeated again and again and again. Labour didn't win in 2010 because its economic competence was rubbish, but because the voters believed the Tory lie. And it was exasperating to hear Gordon Brown didn't even challenge that lie once. He colluded in the Tory message. And what I heard was Labour has a 6-point plan to reduce the deficit. And you lost that. And, you know, people like Mrs. Thatcher couldn't open a mouth without attacking Labour. And we've got to have, you know, people in the party who will attack the Tories. But I'm not sure. In the last election, Ed Miliband was, you know, we heard the same lie from Cameron about the economic deficit. And we heard nothing from Labour. Nothing about defending the BBC. Nothing about the destruction of social housing. What I heard was people talking about, oh, the things I believe in, my vision of a more equal society. But the Tories know that if they attack Labour again and again, as they did in Scotland, they're onto a winner. And they do it all the time. 87, just one.
Basically, yeah, if you could just wrap up, please.
Just one,
yeah.
Lastly. 1987, the Tory message was, with particularly with Salmond, Labour will leave Britain defences. They had these posters with people with their hands up. And the same thing is going to happen in 2020. Believe me.
Thank you. Yes.
Could the questioners please speak up? I can't hear that at all. And panel, please use the mics.
Okay, I hope you can all hear me. Can you all hear me?
Yeah.
4,000 people have died, 4,000 disabled people have died of committing suicide as a result of the work capability assessment. The flood defence budget has been cut and a lot of towns have been flooded. Trade union rights have been attacked and the right to protest have been attacked. And the Tories are talking about cutting our council housing, secure housing altogether. And I basically want to know from the panel, do you think that these issues and many, many others are going to affect the Tory vote negatively, and if not, why not?
Yes.
James mentioned about the sort of, to win in 2020, we need to address Labour's reputation on immigration and its idea of an open borders policy, but with a leader who's very vocal about the support for immigration, which is still going to, I think, is great, how do you foresee Labour winning in 2020 with a leader who's very vocal about this?
Okay, Olivia.
Okay, I'll be quick because I'm running out of time. I'll just say a couple of quick things. The first one on the importance of messaging. I think we've had a lot of very articulate speakers talking about the importance of having a clear message this morning, so I won't repeat what they've said, but I will just share a memory I have from the election campaign when I was working for a member of the Shadow Cabinet. And it was driving in a car to do a broadcast interview one Sunday morning, and she was like, "Oh, has anything just happened that I should know about before I go on TV?" And I said, "Oh yes, we've just revealed a 6-foot tombstone with our 5-point plan on it." And that moment will always stay with me because, you know, we'd had to spend quite a few hours the previous evening memorising the 5-point plan. So I think it says a lot, really, about our message going into the election that it was confused, slightly chaotic at points, and, you know, people want something to vote for. They want to know, you know, they want to go into the ballot box, their pen over the paper and go, "I'm going to do this because I know exactly what's going to happen as a result of it and I'm excited about it." We got nowhere near that at the last election. Unless we get our act together now, we're going to get nowhere near it in 2020. And I suppose that brings me on to the second point, which is, you know, will it affect the Tory vote negatively, all those horrible things that they're doing? Perhaps it will. Perhaps people will see them more for their true colours, but they've saw a lot of them for their true colours in the last Parliament. They didn't have much of an impact. In fact, we lost 2 points to the Tories at the centre. We lost some of our votes to the Conservative Party. And I suppose I would just repeat myself and say we have to find reason for people to vote for us, not just rely on Tory failure. And there will be a lot of it in this Parliament. They're going to destruct themselves every Europe, and they'll make a series of mistakes because they don't think we're a serious opposition, so they'll get lazy, and there'll be plenty of opportunities to seize upon that and to make real progress. But we cannot get away from the fact that we have to construct an alternative and we have to give people something to vote for.
Thank you. Ellie?
Because we need to keep it short, I'm going to answer two of the questions together, so I'm going to answer yours, sir, and yours about immigration. We need to be brief, I'm going to answer your question, sir, and your question about immigration together, and then I'll come to yours. I completely agree with Richard that you need to start where people are. You've got to be honest about the state of the world. You can't exist in a parallel universe which is as you'd like it to be. You need to start where people are. But I also think that that doesn't just mean blindly agreeing with everything that the electorate thinks without trying to make a convincing argument to them otherwise. Because I think what happens when you do that, as we've seen with the deficit, as you said, is that a consensus is formed around a certain idea, and then it makes it even harder to shift the public the other way. I think, you know, if you'd have asked in 2006 the average voter what do they want, they wouldn't have said, "Oh, we want to cut the deficit." The reason that they say that now is because an argument has been made to them over and over again, and Labour has agreed with that, and so people have assumed that that's the right thing. And I think it's a similar thing with immigration. I think it's a huge... I think people are always going to be hostile towards immigration to a certain extent, actually. But I think that the level of hostility can change massively depending on the arguments that you make, the case that you put forward. And also I want to make this point as well about starting from where the electorate's at. One thing I noticed with certain people in the Labour Party is that they'll often say, when it comes to immigration, when it comes to welfare, we have to show the electorate that we're listening. And yet 75% of people want a nationalised rail service, but they never say that about that. Do you know what I mean? And so I do sort of feel like people have to be honest. There has to be a little bit of honesty about the times that you choose to listen to the electorate and the times that you choose to make things unrealistic is an ideological choice. It's not just pragmatism. And then your question, the bad things that the Tories are doing, are they going to damage the Tories? Only if they're pinned on the Tories. Because at the moment, the Tories are pinning all that stuff on everyone else, and they're saying that they have to do all this stuff. So it's not damaging them. And the role, one of the roles of Labour over the next however many years is to make sure that the bad things that the Tories do, that the public see that it's the Tories doing it, and they're not doing it because they have to, they're doing it because they want to. And unless they can do that, then no, it won't affect their vote significantly, I don't think.
Thank you, Richard.
Will what all the terrible things they're doing affect their vote? No, unless we have a compelling alternative to what the Tories are doing, and there is no evidence to say that that's what we are coming up with, and we look like we're going after fetish issues for ourselves and the things that we care about rather than the things that the public cared about at the last election. So don't be surprised if you get a terrible result if we don't actually listen to what they said and do it again. And the bit about attack and negativity is negative campaigning works, being negative does not necessarily, and they don't necessarily lead to the same thing. We were negative about the Tories in so many ways, and what we do in the Labour Party with the Tories at our worst is suggest that we are better people than them, and this rubs people up the wrong way, not least Tory members, and of course it would wind them up, but the people who felt they didn't have a choice last time but to vote Tory because what we were offering them was so little, so insignificant, and not what they wanted. But also it's not an effective way of getting people either to change their minds, and I'm trying to take my advice, my own advice on this about how I behave in the Labour Party in the way I think we should behave in the electorate. So, and I fall down regularly and people pull me up for it, and they're right to, and they will do it again and again. I have to change the same way I think my party does. But the but ultimately, you have to go for their competence to then ascribe their motive afterwards. And if you think about hate crime and how we legislate for this, what used to happen is somebody get beaten up for being gay or Jewish or disabled or whatever it might be, and they'd have to go to the court and prove that that person both beat them up and beat them up because they were black or gay or disabled or whatever it was, right? And one of the great things the Labour government did is separate out the two. You first have the trial on whether or not that person got hit, right, and they got convicted for that, and then afterwards you made an appeal that they hit me because I was gay or black or whatever, right, and the conviction rate on the number of people who went down for homophobic crimes or whatever it was went through the roof in comparison, because previously you could only get the conviction for homophobic hate crime if you could prove they both hit them and why they'd hit them. What we did was separate the two out. We can do the same in politics. Let's go after them for their competence and why they're wrong, and then we can ascribe motive afterwards that they're consistently wrong because of their ideology that takes them down a progressively wrong point. And the final thing on this is, I don't believe Cameron is good at this. I think Cameron is appalling at this, partly because I think he always goes 10% too far, and he's nasty and vindictive and horrid at the dispatch box, and you saw it with how he treated Andrew Eagle, you see it with Ed Miliband. I think he's a vile person. I really, really dislike the man, but I don't think he's actually very good. We just keep being worse than him, and that makes us reflect. But he who shall not be named, in his book A Journey, says when he was leader, he was constantly being advised about how he should attack his opponents. And the advice was always, they're bad, they're evil, they eat babies for breakfast, all the kind of stuff that gets us, you know, why you come to a Fabian conference and get the cheer at the end of it. And he said, I was always looking for the thing that made the kind of centrist Tory MP go, fair point. Because then you might take more people with you. Mm. Ultimately, the role of the leader of the Labour Party is to take all Labour Party members, all Labour Party voters, and get us 1, 2, ideally 3 million more. And then once they've got them, by all means, lose a couple while you're in office, right? But the terrible as that might be. But that is ultimately their job for doing so. And if we can find some attacks on the Tories, not the ones that make us cheer, but the ones that make them go, That's a fair point. Right? We might actually start bringing other people with us. And when we bring other people with us, we get more votes than our opponents, and we can abolish all the terrible laws they brought in this parliament and the last one, and then start correcting this country in the direction we want to do it.
Thank you. And finally, James.
So, I think just on those different things that you mentioned, two things. One, disability. Right? So the obvious place to attack the Tory changes on disability, the disability reforms, is the deaths, right? I mean, these things are, particularly the tests, unbelievably cruel and lead to incredibly bad outcomes. But those outcomes are so bad that when you tell that to average swing voter, they just think it's a cock-up. They don't believe you when you say the Tories so cruel and vindictive that they'll send people to their deaths. That's actually, although in practice it, you know, there are deaths as a result of these changes, it's so implausible that it doesn't land, except for in reams of Labour Party members.
Yeah.
What does land with the general public is to say, particularly on the welfare reforms more broadly, people have paid in all their lives and suddenly they're not going to get stuff that they thought they were going to get. Because that sounds like something that the government might do, in fact is doing, and compromises a value that the Tories are trying to own, which is hard work. So you take the Tories' effort to own the party of working people, which is at the moment absurd, and you say that is they're compromising that. You can also attack them for competence, and in the long run that's the most important thing, but it's harder on the disability work. On housing, it might affect their vote positively, because what they're doing is moving people out of state housing into the private sector, and they think that, like Westminster, that's going to have a long-term positive effect for the Conservative vote by reducing people's reliance on the state and eating away at the Labour vote. It won't be by 2020, but it might be by 2025 if we don't win by then. On immigration, I don't think that Labour can win if it is seen as a party of open borders, do what you like, we don't care, just everyone live their own separate lives. The good news is that isn't what the Labour Party actually thinks. No one thinks go do your own thing. Right? And if you take something like learning English is pretty important for being able to function in a community and activism, all those kinds of things, that you've got to be able to speak the language of the rest of the community. How you fund people to be able to learn English, that's like a policy question. So the Labour Party's reputation is so bad that I don't think it would actually take, you could just move people's perceptions to what the Labour Party centre of gravity is, and that would be a step in the right direction. Not enough to get to a majority, but certainly would help. The idea that this is a concern that is sort of invented is, I think, just wrong. And so if you look at the level of concern and the level of immigration, they track up together. Now, there is always a high level of concern about immigration. There's always a high level of negativity towards immigration. But the salience of immigration has tracked the level of immigration. And there's been a lot, and people have cared about it more. And they care about it, often for very practical reasons. They're worried about how the teacher's going to cope if they've got multiple languages in the school. They think there's not enough social housing, and I've been here all my life and been working hard, how do I get something out of it? So you can have Labour solutions to those kinds of problems, but it's not like a made-up thing. And on the point about rail, it's just really important to look at poll questions which ask whether people care. Right? Because it is true that 75% of people, or roughly, would support rail nationalisation. But unfortunately, only 3% of people care. So they're not going to vote on it. But immigration is the number one issue in the country, immigration, health and the economy at the moment. So people do vote on it. And that's why UKIP got, what did they get, 14%? They didn't get 14% because of Europe position. A quarter of UKIP voters will vote to remain in the EU, and only a quarter of UKIP voters say Europe's one of their top issues. It's nothing to do with Europe. It's only tangentially to do with Europe, or their core is Europe. Their issue is immigration. So it is a voting issue. That's why it matters. The same is true on fiscal trust. Not true on trains. People don't go on trains. Well, pick any of those.
No, it doesn't.
It does, because the point I was making is that... Sorry. But I just want to make the point. The point I was making is not about whether people vote on it or not. I was saying that when you pose the question to a lot of Labour MPs, they say, we can't have rail nationalisation, it's unrealistic. And I'm saying, it's not unrealistic and people want it, so why have it? I'm not saying it's important.
I'm not saying the decision not to have it is ultimately ideological, but you asked the poll question. Thank you all for your questions. Not the most cheerful Fringe meeting I've ever been to, but definitely one of the most thoughtful, so thank you to all of the panel.
Thank you, George.